Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. I'm so glad that you're with me today for this journey of exploring, understanding, explaining, and defending our Catholic faith. We're going to get back to now my series on Easter evidence. We're looking at five things. I'm going to give you a bonus one. There's actually going to be six, but five facts, five minimal facts. And this argument was popularized by one of my professors, Dr. Gary Habermas, and he has looked at thousands of sources from all kinds of different researchers all over the world, no matter what they believe. Some of them are atheists, some of them are agnostics, some of them belong to different religious groups, some of them are Christians, some of them are Catholic. It doesn't matter, but the vast, vast majority of historians, no matter what they believe personally, agree on these minimal facts surrounding Easter. So I want to get back to this Easter evidence because we only got through the first two. Now, just to refresh your memory, here are the five facts. Number one, Jesus died on a Roman cross. Jesus was crucified. That is a historical fact that is absolute bedrock. The second thing, Jesus' tomb was found empty on Easter Sunday morning. Fact number three, we're going to look at this one today. The disciples of Jesus believed that he physically rose from the dead and appeared to them alive after Easter, okay? The fourth fact of the minimal facts that all scholars agree, the vast majority of scholars, let's say, agree upon, no matter what they personally believe, is that Saul the rabbi converted and became Paul the apostle. He went from being a persecutor of the church to its biggest propagator, its biggest evangelist, the conversion of Paul. And then finally, the last point, Jesus' relative James, who was quite skeptical of Jesus before Easter, became a believer and also became the head of the church in Jerusalem. He became a martyr as well for the sake of the gospel, for the truth of Jesus Christ. So again, these are accepted by the vast majority of scholars all around the world as being historical. So these are the minimal facts, and they have to be explained somehow. And I think the only explanation that best fits these facts is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. So let's look at where we left off. Let's go to the third fact, which is the fact that Jesus' disciples believed that he rose physically from the dead, appeared to them alive on Easter Sunday, and for many days following that as well. All right. Well, one of the things that we looked at before is that proximity to the event in question, when you're looking at historical sources, if you can find a source that's close in time to the event itself, that's better than something that's written far off into the future. That doesn't mean that something that's written long after an account isn't historical or isn't true. And for many events of history, that's all we've got. To my recollection, I think there's only one, and I could be wrong about this, but I think there's only one historical source about Caesar crossing the Rubicon. That doesn't mean that didn't happen, just because we have one source. Most people trust that one source and think, yeah, it happens. No, nobody really questions that, even though it was written sometime after the event. But we have a lot of different sources for the events of Easter. It's called multiple attestation. And another thing that we have are sources that are really, really close in time to the event. And that's a good thing because some people want to say, well, you know, the later something is written about an event in history, the more likely it is to be maybe embellished. People's memories are faulty. Maybe the facts aren't remembered quite as well. So earlier is always better if you can get it. Again, it doesn't mean that the later source is wrong, but the oldest tradition in the New Testament with respect to the resurrection of Jesus, it's not in one of the Gospels. I might surprise you to learn that, but it's actually in one of St. Paul's letters, because St. Paul wrote prior to, he wrote at least most of his letters prior to the first Gospel being written. That's what scholars think. So let's look at Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. And again, in a previous series that we did here on The Faith Explained, it was called Saints in Sin City. We dealt with this in a little bit more detail. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. St. Paul is quoting an early creed at the beginning of this chapter in verses 3 through 8 of 1 Corinthians 15. he's quoting an early creed of the Catholic Church. And there are lots of creeds. Now, obviously, there's the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed. There are other creeds of the Catholic Church, like the Athanasian Creed. That one's pretty hardcore. You got to check that out. I love that one. We don't say it at Mass, but we do say on a regular basis the Nicene or the Apostles' Creed. But there are lots of little creeds, too, such as Jesus is Lord. That's a creed. That's maybe the shortest creed. That's in the New Testament. Creeds are basically statements of belief. So we have here a creed that St. Paul quotes in 1 Corinthians 15. Here's what it is. Paul writes, I handed on to you as of first importance what I in turn had received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, that's Peter, that's his Aramaic name, Cephas. His Greek name is Petros, which means rock, but Jesus and the apostles spoke Aramaic on the street. He was known as Cephas. So he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers and sisters at one time, most of whom are still alive, although some have died. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. Now, some people want to ask the question, how do we know that this is a creed? And my professor, Gary Habermas, used to talk about this all the time. First of all, got to remember, this is Rabbi Saul speaking here, right? He was a student of the famous Rabbi Gamaliel. Gamaliel himself is mentioned in the New Testament, the legendary Rabbi Gamaliel. He's mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles. He's even says a few words, saying basically about the early church movement, the early Jesus movement, don't persecute these guys, because what if what they're saying is actually from God? What if they're telling the truth? Then you're going to find yourself fighting against God. Let them go. If it's not from God, it's going to fizzle out. If it is from God, you're not going to be able to shut it down. I'm paraphrasing here, but he was right. Words of wisdom there from Gamaliel. But St. Paul uses words that rabbis would use. These are technical rabbinical terms for passing on of sacred tradition. Okay, so this is kind of like the sacred tradition in a sense. It's very similar to sacred tradition in the Catholic Church. That's oral tradition that everyone was expected to know. It wasn't all necessarily written down, like the Scriptures were written down. But this is what St. Paul says. He says, I handed on what I in turn had received. So handing on and receiving, those Greek terms are technical rabbinical language for passing on sacred tradition. And then there's all these little aids to memorization here. The fact that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised, and that he appeared to all these people. So the "and that" in Greek, that's hoti, okay? That means "and that." And that's the reason why that's put in so many times, it aids memorization. There's kind of a rhythm to it. It's almost like a poem in a certain sense. It aids memorization of this creed. So basically what he's saying to the Corinthian church is that I'm passing this on to you, what I learned from other people. Now, where did he get this and how old is it? That's a really good question. Well, according to the late biblical scholar James Dunn, who was also known as Jimmy Dunn colloquially, he says, quote, this tradition in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 8, we can be entirely confident was formulated as tradition within months of Jesus' death, end of quote. So this is really, really important what he says, that this goes back to within months of the death of Jesus, maybe even weeks after the death of Jesus, this creed was put together. This is like a news flash in the ancient world, even quicker than that. It's like a tweet in real time, or an iMessage, or a WhatsApp message, or something like that. It's a text. Again, a lot of historical events, you don't get any writings on this until hundreds of years after the fact. Here we have something that was composed. Now, Paul wrote it. He wrote it in 1 Corinthians about 50 to 53 A.D., but this creed goes back way earlier. It goes back to within 32 to 35, maybe 38 AD, within this little period, soon after the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And where did he get this from? I'll tell you that in just a second, but I have to digress here for just a moment because I have to tell a quick funny story about this biblical scholar James Dunn, or Jimmy Dunn. Another one of my professors, I just have to tell the story because it's a great story. Another one of my professors, Dr. Craig Evans, he and Jimmy Dunn were in Capernaum, and they were kind of hanging out there. They went to this famous restaurant by the Sea of Galilee where you can get Peter's fish, the same kind of fish that Peter would have caught as a fisherman. And it's tilapia. It's really good fish. At any rate, well, James Dunn excused himself during the meal to, you know, use the facilities or whatever. They had ordered their fish. And while he was gone, the fish showed up at the table. And Dr. Evans decided to play a little trick on Dr. Dunn. So he took out a coin, a Roman coin, and he put it in the mouth of the fish. And because they give you the whole fish, head and all, on the plate in Capernaum. And he put a little Roman coin in the mouth of the fish. And guess what? Jimmy Dunn comes back to the table, and Craig Evans says, "Hey, what's that in the mouth of your fish there? What's that?" And he checks it out. The coin is there, and James Dunn just absolutely fell off his chair laughing. It was unbelievable, because, of course, that's a reference to the famous story about the temple tax. Jesus tells Peter to go fishing. You'll pick the first fish you get, open its mouth, you'll find a coin. That'll be enough to pay the temple tax for you and for me. So I thought it was great that Dr. Evans reenacted that for Dr. Dunn. I just wanted to tell that quick, funny story. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. All right, let's get back to what he was saying, though, about the fact that this creed, this statement of belief about Jesus' resurrection, this is the earliest thing that we have that was written down about the resurrection of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15. This is an early creed, goes back to within mere months of the death, resurrection of Christ. Well, where did Paul get this from? Well, most people think he got it because he said, "I received it and I'm passing it on to you. I didn't invent this creed." He got it from Peter himself and also from James in Jerusalem. When did he get it? Well, he got it when he went to visit them after Paul's conversion. Paul goes into the desert. He goes into Arabia. He's there for 3 years. He comes out. The first thing he does, he's kind of on this extended spiritual retreat with Jesus. He's appeared to him on the Damascus Road. So he goes and has all these mystical experiences, intense prayer life with Christ. And then he comes back. And the first thing he wants to do is to check in with the apostles who knew Jesus during his earthly ministry. And don't forget, Paul didn't know Jesus during his earthly ministry, unless he bumped into him in the temple at one point, but he didn't know who he was. He certainly didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah. He was persecuting the early church. But after he converts, of course, people are really skeptical. You tell me Paul now believes? Give me a break. Or Saul, who's known as Saul at the time, he now believes. He was trying to kill us just a few days ago. I'm not sure I buy this. Maybe he's trying to get close to us so he can do us all in. So there's a lot of skeptics, as you can imagine. But this is what Paul actually says about his conversion and about how he visited Peter and James. All right, so I want to just back up a little bit to Galatians chapter 1. Let's start with verse 11. Here's what Paul writes. He says, "Brethren, I would have you know that the gospel which was preached by me is not man's gospel." In other words, not of human origin. "For I did not receive it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through a revelation of Jesus Christ. For you have heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it, and I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. But when he who had set me apart before I was born and had called me through his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not confer with flesh and blood, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia, and again I returned to Damascus." Okay, so there's the retreat there. Then he says this, "Then after 3 years I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas, and remained with him 15 days. Boy, just to interject here, I would give anything to be a fly on the wall during those 15 days, Peter getting caught up, getting Paul caught up on the earthly life, the earthly ministry of Jesus, everything that he's been missing. Wow. And then he says this. So he visited Peter for 15 days, and he says in verse 19 of Galatians 1, "But I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. Now, that doesn't mean that he's another son of Mary, the brother of the Lord. Okay, well, who is James Holt? We'll talk about that maybe later on. But he is, I think he's probably a relative of Jesus, not a son of Mary, but he is related to Jesus, I think. Paul writes, "In what I am writing to you before God, I do not lie. Then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia, and I was still not known by sight to the churches of Christ in Judea. They only heard it said, 'He who once persecuted us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy.' And they glorified God because of me." So most people think that Paul would have had to have gotten this creed from Jerusalem, from Peter and James, when he was visiting them sometime after his conversion. So that's where he got it, and he passed it on. So this is really important. Again, really, really close in time to the event and this creed, this early creed. You know, Sir Winston Churchill once said this. It was a great quip. He said, "A lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on." All right. So this is why it's really, really important to not only get close to events in time as you can possibly get, but also to have eyewitness testimony. Because if somebody does lie or fabricate an event, say, "Oh, no, this really happened." Well, no, it didn't, because I was there. That's why eyewitnesses are really, really important. Because eyewitnesses were around. Tons of eyewitnesses were around from Jesus' ministry, from his miracles. They're still walking around in Judea, in Israel. They easily could have verified or not these events. And Paul says there are many, many eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection that are still alive. When he's writing to the Corinthians, he says there are 500 people, in fact, that saw him at the same time, most of whom are still alive, although some have fallen asleep. By that he means they died. So he's basically daring folks to interview these people. He would never have said this unless he could back it up. So this is really, really a good reason to trust Paul in what he's saying there. Now, my friend Greg Manette, he wrote this great book called The Wrong Jesus. In that book, he quotes a historian, a classical historian named A.N. Sherwin White. And Mr. Sherwin White says this: "It takes longer than two generations for legendary embellishments to wipe out the core of historical facts." So it takes, if there are legendary embellishments, it takes two generations. How long is a generation? 40 years. So two generations, obviously 80 years. I'm bad at math, but I can figure that out. So this protects, the entire New Testament is protected from legendary embellishment. You have to understand that, because I'm somebody who believes that all of the New Testament books were written prior to 70 AD, the destruction of the temple, because not one of the books of the New Testament, the 27 books, mentions this fact, which is unbelievable given how important the temple was to the Jews. It was like the destruction of the universe. So when the Romans destroyed it in 70 AD, it's alluded to, it's prophesied in the New Testament. But most of the books are basically telling us the temple is still standing. And the rest, it's kind of ambiguous. I don't think any biblical book would fail to mention this fact, because they'd say, "Look, see, just like Jesus predicted, the temple was destroyed because he was rejected as Messiah." So I think the entire New Testament was done by 70 AD. So that's one generation from the death of Jesus, okay? So it's all protected. It's all protected. This is not legendary. All right, so very close to the event, also multiple attestation. All the resurrection appearances that Paul mentions in this creed. There's also resurrection appearances mentioned in the gospel. Some of them are probably the same events. Let me just really quickly, let me go through the resurrection appearances in the Gospels, and we'll see how they correlate with this creed that St. Paul brings about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. All right, I'm going to give you 12 resurrection appearances from the Gospels. First of all, Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene at the tomb early Sunday morning on Easter Sunday. You can read about this in Mark chapter 16, verse 9, also in John chapter 20, verses 11 through 18. Okay, so he appears to Mary. He also appears to a group of other women. near the tomb, again, Sunday morning, Matthew 28, verses 8 to 10, John chapter 20, once again, verses 11 through 18. There's also, of course, a special appearance to Peter, and that's specifically mentioned in this 1 Corinthians Creed. He appeared to Cephas. It's also mentioned, by the way, in Luke 24, verse 34. So there's no narration, unfortunately, in the Gospels of this is what happened when Jesus appeared to Peter, and he says, I forgive you, whatever. That's not there. That initial appearance to Peter is not there. Now, later on, by the Sea of Tiberias, he does encounter Peter and the apostles again at breakfast time, John chapter 20. Yeah, but that initial appearance to Peter, we don't have it. But we do have talk about it in the New Testament. Then, of course, he appeared to Clopas. Now, most people think it's Clopas and a companion, the two that were on the road to Emmaus. And, of course, we know that that's in Luke chapter 24. And it's also alluded to in Mark chapter 16, verses 12 and 13. That probably happened in the afternoon, on that first Easter Sunday day. Then Jesus appears to the 11, that's appearance number 5, in the upper room on the Sunday evening of Easter. Luke 24, that's where he says, hey, you know, I'm not a ghost, I have flesh and bones, you can touch me and see, give me something to eat, ghosts don't make food disappear. He eats a piece of broiled fish in front of them. John chapter 20 is also probably in view here, and that is also mentioned in the Corinthian Creed, in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5. Then we have another appearance to the 11, which happens a week later, the next Sunday. Remember, doubting Thomas, he wasn't there the first time, well, he's here now. You can read about this in John chapter 20. Jesus says, hey, touch my wounds, see that's me. You believe now because you've seen me. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet still believe. And then there's a seventh appearance to about 120 of the believers that happens in Jerusalem 40 days after Easter. You can read about that in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 1, verses 3 to 11. Then there's another appearance to the 11 in Galilee. That's in Matthew 28. This is right before he ascends into heaven. Matthew 28. It's also in Mark 16. It's in John chapter 21. Then there's this appearance to the 500. That's mentioned in the Corinthian Creed, 1 Corinthians 15, 6. The appearance to James, also in the Creed, 15, 7. The appearance to more apostles. That's in 15, verse 7 as well. And then, of course, Paul mentions himself, how Jesus appeared to him in the road to Damascus. And, of course, he narrates this a few times in the Acts of the Apostles, for example, in Acts chapter 9, tells his conversion story. And that's in the Creed as well, this appearance to Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 8. So I've just given you 12 different resurrection appearances of the risen Christ. A lot of them are mentioned specifically in this 1 Corinthians Creed. Some of them aren't, but they're in the Gospels. And so we have eyewitnesses. Jesus appeared individually, in groups of people, including this stupendous appearance to more than 500 people at one time, most of whom are still alive when Paul is writing. So this is absolutely wild. This is great, great evidence that's close in time and also eyewitness evidence to the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, and Manetta mentions this in his book, there's an atheist New Testament scholar. Can you believe that? Yes, there are atheist New Testament scholars. One of them is named Gerd Ludemann. He's pretty well known. This is what he said about the resurrection appearances of Jesus. He says, quote, it may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ, end of quote. Okay, so he says it's historically certain that the disciples had experiences of Jesus after his death. He appears to them as the risen Christ. I'm sure you're asking the question, hang on here. If Gerd Ludemann actually believes that that happened, then why is he still an atheist? Well, here's part of the reason why. He doesn't believe that Jesus was resurrected. He believes that what was actually happening to the disciples is that they were simply hallucinating. Okay, we're going to deal with that objection. That's one of the objections to the resurrection of Jesus, that they were all hallucinations, that Jesus wasn't really there. I'm going to talk about that later. Right at the end of this series, I'm going to go through some major objections to the resurrection and refute them. But I'll just say this really quickly in response to this. You can't share a hallucination with someone else. It's medically impossible. So these group appearances that Jesus has, including the 500 people at one time, you can't fake that. And in all the resurrection appearances, Jesus presents himself as physical, not a ghost, not a spirit, not a vision. He can be touched. He can eat food. He's real. And don't forget, whatever explanation you have for Easter has to explain all the five facts, including the empty tomb. If it's only a hallucination, where's the body? That's really important to know. So we got to stop it there for right now. You've been listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark, going through some Easter evidence, some five minimal facts popularized by one of my professors, Dr. Gary Habermas. It's a great way to help skeptics understand that there is solid evidence for Easter. And hopefully convince them to maybe take a step of faith in the direction that the evidence points. That's all the time we have for today. But if you have a question about the Catholic faith, I'll try to answer it on the air. You can send it to me via email. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com. Or you can try to get your question to me on the X app. My handle is @CaleClark. I'll be with you later today at 5 p.m. Central for the Cale Clark Show live on Relevant Radio. And I'll see you in the next episode of The Faith Explained. God bless.